From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel on violence in politics. Prior state prosecutors tell her the vitriol of this moment is new.
He said there was nothing like what we're seeing now. The threats that are made to you routinely were virtually never made to Bill Schuette in his 8 years of office.
Also, two journalists capture the damage to and the delights of the Great Lakes.
I think there's still so much to celebrate and love about the lakes.
And a new Rhodes Scholarship goes to a Michigan senior looking to push back on hallowed traditions in academia.
I think anyone who claims working solely within institutions to create change hasn't taken a look at history. But at the same time, I believe in learning to speak the language of those in the halls of power in order to make change.
Those stories coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, the Great Lakes. They're arguably the defining feature of our state, and they're up against some serious ecological threats.
Algal blooms pretty much disappeared from the lakes until the mid-90s.
That's coming up later in the program, but first, protesters gathered outside of Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson's home over the weekend. Some of them were reportedly armed. The police were called. Benson says the protesters arrived as she, her husband, and her four-year-old son were decorating for Christmas. The group that arrived was angry about results of the election of Joe Biden in Michigan. They maintain that election was stolen. Joe Biden won Michigan's vote by more than 150,000. This is not the first time that threatening actions and messages have come into play. State Representative Cynthia Johnson of Detroit reported threatening messages sent to her after a committee hearing on election results. Monica Palmer, a Republican member of the Wayne County Board of Canvassers, also received threats after a contentious meeting to certify election results. Here to talk with us about how her office handles threats of violence against elected officials is Michigan's Attorney General Dana Nessel. Attorney General Nessel, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
What can you tell us about the protest at Secretary Benson's house this weekend?
Well, it's very alarming and concerning, you know. And honestly, I would say that the behavior that I saw in regard to the event Saturday night was an affront to basic morality and decency. It's behavior that's masquerading as a protest, but that's not really what it is. It's an attempt to instill fear into our public officials. And we're seeing it over and over again. And I don't care if you're a Democrat, a Republican, an independent, you know, what have you. No public official should have to endure that kind of protest, especially at their home under the circumstances under which this occurred. I don't feel as though this is First Amendment protected activity. We have, certain guidelines and restrictions on the First Amendment, and you can't just protest anywhere, anytime, any way in which you like without also violating other laws.
So several reporters said on social media that there were people among the protesters who were armed. First of all, do you have any information about that? And second of all, would it matter to you if they were?
Well, I think that it makes it more concerning when you know that you have people that are, you know, belligerent. They wait until the dark of night to go out to her private residence. They are shouting, you know, through bullhorns. Some of them are referring to her as being a murderer. And to know that when you're armed, of course, you have the ability to inflict harm in a way that you otherwise would not. Normally, you're behind closed doors in the safety and security of your home. You have less to worry about. Of course, it's more threatening when you know that somebody can simply pull out a weapon and shoot into your home and cause death or great bodily harm to you or your family. Yeah, I think that escalates it.
What does Michigan's law say about intimidation and free speech and where the difference lies?
Well, again, you know, as much as we have broad First Amendment protections, they do not allow one to use the cloak of the First Amendment as a guise under which you can perform illegal activities. So credible threats, for instance, credible threats of harm or violence, great bodily harm, those are not acceptable. Those are never okay. If you are talking about even protests of the nature that we saw, again, you know, you cannot go into a private neighborhood at nighttime and break all other kinds of ordinance infractions, such as trespassing. You know, it appeared from the videos that they went onto her lawn and her driveway. There are noise ordinances that do not allow you to use some sort of an amplifier. And a number of these people had bull horns that they were shouting through that echoed all throughout the neighborhood. And then there are disorderly conduct types of charges that I would argue could also apply to an event like this. But certainly in terms of the types of threats that we've seen, not just against Secretary Benson, but also I would say certainly Representative Johnson has been playing a number of these threats that she's received. These are threats to kill her, and they're illegal. You absolutely cannot use an electronic device to disseminate threats of violence. And I will say that we made it clear that we were investigating threats that were made against the Republicans that were on the Wayne County Board of Canvassers, because those are, if true, and if those can be verified, those are absolutely illegal acts, and no public servant should have to put up with that kind of behavior.
Is anything going to happen to the protesters who were at Secretary Benson's house?
Well, that remains to be seen, because there were no arrests that were performed. And normally how it works, you know, we are a prosecutor's office, among other things, at the Department of Attorney General. We handle criminal cases all the time, but we need for there to be a warrant that is brought to our office when an arrest is made on the scene. And it's hard, because as much as you can try to utilize videos to discern what, if any, infractions were committed, it's much easier when there's a police officer on the scene that actually either makes an arrest or they issue a citation right on the scene. And then they make notes as to what the infraction was that that individual violated. But it's a lot harder when all we have are videos that are, you know, in the dark, to try to discern that now that the event is over. I would say, though, for the future, I would be very wary, if I was anybody, thinking of going to a person's personal private residence late at night to engage in that kind of behavior. I do not believe that it ought to be tolerated. And I believe under the circumstances under which it occurred on Saturday night, as I indicated, I believe there were a number of infractions.
Are you frustrated? You know, if there weren't any arrests made, what is to stop protesters from taking away from this situation? Why shouldn't they go and protest in this manner again?
Well, I hope that me making these statements to you today and understanding that I'm going to be working with law enforcement, firstly, definitely in the city of Detroit and in Wayne County as it pertains to the acts at Secretary Benson's home, because I did hear some of those individuals say that they intended to come back each and every night. So they should be cautious and they should be forewarned that there will be a greater police presence in the event they do that again, and that they should be concerned that if they violate any state law or they violate city ordinances, that they're going to be held accountable. And, you know, I'm sorry that that wasn't done on Saturday night. And my understanding is that the police arrived on the scene after that had been going on for quite some time. And I don't know if they dispersed immediately or pretty quickly upon the arrival of the police. I think that normally the approach of the police is just to try to get people away from a scene if they possibly can, but you'd really have to ask them that question. But what I want to make clear, whether these are acts that occur at the Capitol, where you have armed gunmen who are in the building, whether it happens to be protests against, you know, Department of Health and Human Services rules, regulations, orders, whatever it is, just because you have the intent to protest something that you don't like doesn't make your activity legal. And oftentimes it is not. And so when we talk about civil disobedience, you know, civil disobedience has a long history in our society. But what we have to generally expect to happen is that if you commit crimes during the course you're protesting, then you have to be held accountable legally, because there are certain things that are still against the law, no matter what the reason is that you're engaging in that conduct.
You know, if there's an upside to this year's elections and everything that's come with it, you know, maybe it's that so many people participated in the democratic process. And some of the protesters have tried to cast it as this is just Americans exercising their legal rights and exercising their opinions on the election. At what point does democratic participation reach a place where it is inciting people to do things that are not legal?
Well, we know that it's inciting people to do things that are not legal. And we know that in part, the individuals that were charged with their plot to kidnap and later execute the governor were motivated in part by those who were talking about liberating Michigan or fighting back against what they called a dictatorship, for the governor having the audacity to try to protect state residents against COVID and the many terrible harms that come to people as a result of being infected or passing it along to their friends or family members. You know, we know that this kind of harsh, angry rhetoric, there is cause and effect. And we have continued to see this. And I can't understand why we don't have more Republicans out there who are disavowing this type of conduct and who are rebuking it and saying loudly and clearly that this sort of conduct should not be tolerated. And I would be very careful if I were them, because they have to understand that if this kind of quote unquote demonstration can be done at the private residence of a Democrat, certainly it can also happen at the home of a Republican. And I don't think they would appreciate that very much, nor do I think that this should happen to anybody. And we need to have each and every Republican in this state, whether you are a local official, whether you're a state official or a federal official, indicate that Joe Biden is a winner of the election, that it was a free and fair election, and that people need to stop this nonsense and move on the same way, frankly, the Democrats did after the 2016 election. You might have seen protests take place in public squares, but you certainly didn't see people going to people's homes, at the homes of election officials, to scream and yell and threaten them.
The perception is that in recent months, protesters have escalated the kind of threats that they're making, and they have escalated their methods. Do you think that's actually true? Is there more going on now than your office might normally be dealing with?
Absolutely. I know that it's true. Many of the things that we're seeing now historically have not been seen. And, you know, I thought it was interesting, since I took office, for instance, when we have had discussions in my office about security measures for me and the death threats that I've received, I asked the individual who was in charge of security for my predecessor, Bill Schuette. I said, well, you're probably used to this. You probably see this all the time. And you had plans in place, of course, to protect General Schuette. And he said, no. He said, that was nothing like what we're seeing now. The threats that are made to you routinely were virtually never made to Bill Schuette in his 8 years of office. So I know for a fact that there's a big difference now than there was before.
Dana Nessel is the Attorney General for the state of Michigan. Thank you very much for talking to us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we meet a University of Michigan senior selected for the prestigious Rhodes Scholarship. That's next. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. For public land advocates in Michigan, Christmas comes the first week in December every year. That's the time when the Michigan Natural Resources Trust Fund Board decides how to spend the earnings of its massive endowment. Interlochen Public Radio's Lexi Krupp explains this annual tradition.
There was a big pot of money at stake this year, $42 million to fund public land projects. And it's a small group of people who decide how to dish the money out.
Steve Hamp.
Dan Eichinger.
Aaron McDonough.
Sam Cummings.
I'm Bill Rustem. I'm the current chair of the Natural Resources Trust Fund Board.
The board reviews applications for projects like buying lakefront property for public use or building restrooms at a town park. Proposals get a score, and the ones higher up have a better shot to get funding. But the final call is at the board's discretion.
I know there are a couple of projects that I have a particular interest in that I'd like to bubble up to my fellow board members.
Glenn Chown, the director of the Grand Traverse Regional Land Conservancy, says they can still fund projects that don't score very well.
The ranking system is sort of a guide to try to make sense and, you know, prioritize. And that gets them about 70% of the way there.
So the day of the meeting, the applicants show up and plead their cases, like Dave Coulter, an Oakland County executive.
It's not often that an opportunity comes along in our area.
Then the board starts divvying up the money. It's sort of like an Oprah Winfrey show. You get $100,000, and you get $100,000, and you get $100,000. Only it's without any of the network television glitz.
You know, we're going to look at the spreadsheet.
The big laundry list they had to go through had more than 100 projects this year. Some are for big ticket items, like buying hundreds of acres along Lake Michigan at an old sand mining property in Muskegon. Others are for smaller projects. That can still be a big deal for the communities applying. Like one on the roster this year is in Whitefish Township, up in the eastern UP. They need to rebuild the road and parking lot at the town beach, because right now, it's basically covered in a sand dune. That's according to Edson Forrester. He's a township trustee.
Right now, there's a lot of sand pits. People get stuck in there. There's only one-way traffic, and it's kind of difficult for people to use that lakeshore.
The board approved $185,000 for the project. And Discovery Pier, just north of Traverse City, needs bathrooms and better access for people with mobility issues. They're slated to get $300,000. And in Sheboygan, there's a popular fishing spot right in the middle of town. Caroline Keeson with the Tip of the Mitt Watershed Council says right now it's this steep bank.
It's really only accessible for like the most agile angler.
They're also set to get $300,000 to build a boardwalk and fishing platforms.
Well, I guess I'm going to have to go fishing out of the river now.
And all of these projects were pretty highly rated. Most applicants expected to get funding. But Glenn Chown from the Grand Traverse Regional Land Conservancy had a project with a lower score. He wasn't sure if it was going to get this trust fund money.
I have not been sleeping too well the last 2 nights.
It was to purchase a piece of waterfront property on Crystal Lake in Benzie County. It's an area called Railroad Point. He made a comment at the start of the meeting as a final pitch.
This year's scoring does not truly reflect the importance of this property. Acquisition of this final high-priority conservation parcel would be the capstone, representing the culmination of a grand and bold vision.
It worked. The project was awarded more than $700,000. He was pretty happy about the decision.
We're ringing bells. You want to hear me ring the bell? Tonight we might even have to break out a little champagne.
It was one of 76 proposals funded this year. Over the trust fund's more than 40-year history, it's invested over $1 billion in the state. It's a big reason why Michigan has some of the most public lands east of the Mississippi. I'm Lexi Krupp.
It's pretty hard for students to see past the end of the academic year, with COVID having frozen so many of our schools and institutions in place. Difficult to imagine what this must be like for those coming out of college. One University of Michigan senior just got an enormous boost for her future plans. Amy Tess Gerges, whose major is political science, has been selected for the next class of Rhodes Scholarships. In a normal year, that would mean a trip to the UK and extended studies at Oxford. For 2021, that plan is mostly intact. She joins us now to explain. Amy Tess Gerges, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
How does it feel to have been selected for such a huge scholarship?
To be honest with you, almost 2 weeks later, I'm still completely in shock. There's such a strong contrast between the work I've been doing throughout undergrad with so many people who are incredible and brilliant and yet would never get a chance to be in those rooms.
I want to give people a sense of sort of where your academic work has led you and where your brain is. Your senior thesis is about mutual aid groups during COVID-19. It's obviously super timely. What led you to focus on that?
In the political science department, we are supposed to decide what we want to write our thesis on pretty early. So I had already decided on another topic before COVID hit. And when I saw the incredible outpouring of mutual aid happening in my community and around the country, and the contrast between this work and the sort of lack of literature on that in political science and elsewhere, I just knew it was really, really important to cover how people were coping with state neglect during this time.
When you talk about mutual aid, do you mean like super micro interactions between people on a block, or do you mean maybe small grassroots community groups that just mobilized and became very active during the course of the pandemic?
You know, part of the contribution to the literature I'm hoping to make is to figure out how we want to define mutual aid in this moment. the sort of radical tradition definition of mutual aid is horizontally governed webs of community members helping one another. The catchphrase is solidarity, not charity. So essentially, one person needs something, another person needs another thing. They're working together to make it happen. It's not merely the privileged giving coats or money to the underprivileged. As far as whether it's a registered organization or not, it could really go either way. But I'm really trying to figure out in this moment what types of mutual aid groups have emerged and whether or not all of them even fit a traditional definition.
Yeah. What are some of the groups that you've had an eye on?
One of the most fantastic groups is the Mutual Aid Network of Ypsilanti. They have been around long before COVID started, and they are consistently doing the work of supporting each other in the Ypsilanti community. But I've also got a database of mutual aid groups that have been both pre-COVID or started post-COVID across the country. And they range everywhere from rural Kentucky to the middle of Brooklyn. So it's been a really interesting range of stuff.
The group that you mentioned in Ypsilanti, what are some of the kinds of things that they've started doing?
So they're primarily focused on getting things to people who need them. So whether that's money for rent, whether that's groceries, clothing, but they're also really, really focused on building community and building the power to, you know, mount to necessary political action as well. So for example, when the mayor of Ypsilanti over the summer, you know, made some racist comments, they were really big advocates in getting her to step down, and they just do what it takes to empower the Ypsilanti community.
With regards to the Rhodes Scholarship, you've said some things about how getting this honor is amazing and also involves a bit of whiplash for you personally in thinking about your place in the universe where the Rhodes Scholarship was created. Could you talk a little bit about what you mean by that?
You know, with an Iranian-Egyptian heritage, I grew up watching the countries I love encountering democratic backsliding, dealing with crippling sanctions, violence, the whole deal. And frankly, that is directly related to the legacies of colonial and Western interference. And number one on that list is the United Kingdom. And so Cecil Rhodes being the namesake and the funder of the Rhodes Trust, one of the most infamous colonizers and eugenicists in history, really wrestling with what it looks like for me to be working my entire life towards reparations and reconciliation while also entering this environment has been really, really interesting. But I'll also say that, you know, the Rhodes Trust is well aware of the legacy, and countless former and present Rhodes scholars have called them out for that. So it's definitely not like I'm saying anything new.
Are you planning to head to Oxford next October?
At the moment, yes.
Wow. What is the program? Yeah. What has the program told you about what to expect and whether the program is actually going to go forward in the way that it has in the past? I mean, do you know if you're going to be able to attend classes even?
They have absolutely no way to predict what will happen. I know that the current Rhodes class in the year above me was doing a lot of school online, you know, but still went over to the UK. So worst case scenario, we'll end up in something like that. But I'm hopeful that we can at least get halfway back to normal by next October.
Assuming that you are able to do some kind of work in person, what would you like to focus on in Oxford?
All of undergrad, I've spent a lot of time doing work outside of the classroom. And frankly, not spending as much time as I would have liked doing deep dive on the theory and practice of radical social movement tradition. And so what I'm really hoping to do at Oxford is study similar topics to what I'm studying now, looking to get an MPhil, hopefully in comparative politics or sociology, and write a dissertation, hopefully, on the ways in which community organizations mount towards social movements.
What kind of different political angle do you think you might get on such things at a place like Oxford?
Yeah, it's really interesting because Oxford obviously is a college town that houses one of the most prestigious universities in the world, but it's also a 45-minute train ride from London. And also the United Kingdom as a whole is very much in a similar political moment as the United States with regards to tensions between the far right and the populist left. And so I'm really, really interested to see how things are both similar and different in the United Kingdom compared to here.
My guest today is Amy Tess Gerges. She has just been accepted for a Rhodes Scholarship and is anticipating heading to Oxford, England to study in fall of 2021. I'm so interested by the way that you sort of think about working on power structures outside of institutions while you're fueled within institutions.
Yes.
It's not, you know, it's something that a lot of people involved in academic work, you know, kind of have to think about and figure out and come to terms with. But are you at a place in your life where you do feel like the institutions we have, warts and all, still have useful things to show us, or, you know, to give us the space to figure out what we need to about society to make things work better?
Well, I am 21 years old, and I have a feeling that this is a question I'll be asking for the rest of my life. But at the moment, I tend to favor a two-pronged approach towards building power. And what I mean by that is I think anyone who claims working solely within institutions to create change hasn't taken a look at history. But at the same time, I believe in learning to speak the language of those in the halls of power in order to make change. So, you know, when you look back over the course of history, in the United States, no significant change has ever been made via incremental legal change, right? It's always been people in the streets demanding urgent action. And then that translates to a change in popular consciousness, which translates to political change. So I think we need people on the inside and the outside, and who knows where I'll land.
You know, this would be a pretty stunning achievement at any point, but it's so crazy that this honor came to you in a year when the world has been frozen for a lot of people. And many, many, many of us, either those involved in schools or just in their jobs, are just sort of trying to get by. What has that been like, thinking about making a radical leap while everything is at a standstill?
Like many others, this year has been one of standstill, growth, and in many ways planting seeds that I don't know whether or not they will sprout. And so to have gotten the sudden news of winning an award that I absolutely was not expecting to win as someone who's about to graduate college and thinking that I would have to find a job or, you know, plunge into this deep void of the future, it's been really a shock to the system, but I think is emblematic of the juxtapositions that this entire year has brought me.
Do you feel like you're going to have time to get your head around this before things start moving forward?
I don't think I'll ever get my head around it, to be honest with you. I think I'm going to show up to Oxford and be like, what the hell is going on? But that's been the story of my life, so we'll figure it out.
So this year's Rhodes Scholarship class includes 22 students who are people of color. That means it's one of the most diverse groups of scholars in the program's whole history. What do you think that means for the program?
There has been a lot of talk about how this American Rhodes class has been the most diverse of any class in history. And it has been, and that's phenomenal. But I also really want to emphasize that diversity isn't enough. And I'm really, really excited. I'm already talking to the incoming scholars, and all of us are committed to doing the work to uplift the identities of the marginalized, both those that we inhabit and those that we don't. And so I just think that's a really important thing to mention when we're talking about diversity, is that the fact that I'm an Iranian Egyptian American woman is not enough. I also hope to be doing the work to represent that.
Could you say a little more about what might move the needle if it's not just the selection of a diverse range of scholars?
Yeah. You know, change often comes with growing pains and misunderstandings. And I think lately what we've seen in many elite institutions, both political and academic and otherwise, is a tokenizing of people of color and Black people especially to claim that progress is being made. And that doesn't mean progress isn't being made, but it's not enough to merely pick someone for their identity. The Rhodes Trust and, frankly, American politics, which is struggling with the same issue, needs to really be focusing on having actions, whether it be policy or where the money is going, to uplift people who have those identities who are not the ones in those rooms.
Amy Tess Gerges, thank you so much for talking with us. And hang on. I'm sure the ride's going to get more interesting before it gets boring.
Yeah. Thank you so much for taking the time to do the interview.
Up next, we speak with the writer and photographer team who collaborated on this month's National Geographic cover story on saving the Great Lakes.
I can imagine, like, Saudi Arabia would probably offer all their oil fields. If they could have one of our Great Lakes, then and we would be wise to turn them down.
We'll meet him after a short break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The cover story in this month's edition of National Geographic takes a deep dive into some of the major threats to the health of the Great Lakes. Within these pages, you'll find some very dramatic photos of massive algal blooms, surging floodwaters, and up-close portraits of species that are disrupting local ecosystems. We're speaking today with the writer and photographer behind the story. Tim Folger is a National Geographic contributing writer. He's also a contributing editor at Discover Magazine. Hi, Tim.
Hi, April. Thanks for having me today.
And Keith Ladzinski is also here. He's a photographer at Nat Geo, as well as a filmmaker. Keith, good to have you with us.
Thanks, April. It's great to be here.
Tim, you write in the story that the Great Lakes might be the most precious resource in North America. I mean, that's not a hard sell here in Michigan, but I wondered why you chose those words. What makes them so important?
It's really hard to overstate just how valuable the Great Lakes are. They supply drinking water to something like 40 million people in Canada and the United States. They support a multi-billion dollar, you know, sport fishing industry. Not just to mention just the life that the lake, the wildlife that the lakes sustain, and the commerce and just the sheer beauty of the place. You know, this assignment was my real first exposure to the Great Lakes. I was a this is a completely new subject for me. And it was just eye-opening that we have this region in our country that any other country, you know, would kill to have. You know, I can imagine, like, Saudi Arabia would probably offer all their oil fields. If they could have one of our Great Lakes, then, and we would be wise to turn them down.
How have the point sources for pollution changed for the Great Lakes? I mean, many people in this region are familiar with the history and the story of how the Great Lakes were redeemed and saved in the 1970s, and that some of that process brought unintended consequences. But what did you need people to know about the pollution map right now?
Algae blooms were a problem that we thought we had solved. They used to recur almost every summer, you know, from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. But then with the Clean Water Act, which, you know, just started regulating the amounts of pollutants that could flow in from point sources like sewage treatment plants, algal blooms pretty much disappeared from the lakes until the mid-90s. Then they started reappearing. And now for at least the past decade, they've been happening almost every summer. So, you know, so what happened? Why did they come back? And it's a combination of things. It's strangely enough, some practices that were intended to benefit the lakes have contributed to the resurgence of algal blooms. In the 1990s, farmers adopted this no-till agriculture where they reduced the amount of plowing that they did on their fields. And that was great in terms of reducing soil erosion. You know, we need to preserve our topsoil, and, you know, this no-till agriculture does that. But paradoxically, plowing actually helps work fertilizer more deeply into the soil, which means that it's less likely to run off. But with no-till agriculture, farmers started broadcasting fertilizer on top of their fields, and it washes off more easily into the lakes. And there's kind of a double whammy going on too, with climate change is increasing the amount of heavy spring rainfall. And throughout the year, one of the effects of climate change is that we'll see more precipitation in terms of rainfall rather than snow. So with heavy spring rains, you know, which are occurring basically at the same time that farmers are planting their fertilizer, you're getting all of this runoff into the lakes, which fuels algal blooms. You know, the phosphorus is like sugar for algae.
Keith, this is where your superpowers come into play. You've got a couple of photos in the piece of a very vividly colored green algal bloom in Lake Erie. And the caption notes just how big it was. At its peak, this thing covered about 600 square miles. What was it like trying to capture an image of something so enormous and so destructive?
It was certainly an astonishing thing to see. And the big challenge is, I think, when you're dealing with something that is 600 square miles, that you need scale. You need something that communicates that. And a lot of the things I was setting out to do was to find little elements of, you know, where you could see where the green meets civilization, for instance, being one of the shots. You know, there's a picture that shows a little private dock within a small community on the shores of Lake Erie. And you can see this big green influx in the water right when it turns into residential. And, you know, I think that really shows how quickly we're being, you know, the effect that humans are undergoing with this. For the picture to be even more impactful, you needed that piece of scale, that something recognizable so the viewer could anchor into and say, wow, that's a boat. And this just goes on into infinity.
Yeah, you can see, like, this is why this is so desperately wrong. You also, there's another photo in which floodwaters are swirling through the town of Port Clinton in Ohio. They had experienced record lake levels in 2019, as many towns along the lakes have. What does the increased threat of flooding mean for the communities that you got a chance to see and interact with?
I mean, it's going to be, as Tim sort of had outlined, with this influx of rain being something that we're only going to continue to see more and more as heat index continues to rise. The unfortunate effect here is that all of these communities that live on the fringe of the lake, which is pretty much the most desirable real estate, is to be close to any one of these given lakes. You know, just last year alone, there was some $1 billion worth of damage. This is unfortunately just now a piece of what is to be expected. Climate change, all of this information that we've been warned about for some 30 plus years, we're now starting to see in real time taking place in areas like this. I mean, that is ground zero. And unfortunately, I don't think that there's really much of an end in sight here. It's really just going to come down to, you know, new construction efforts in order to combat this, which I don't even know it. It's just going to be an overwhelming situation. I wish I had a good answer to what that looks like, but seeing it firsthand, and I 2 years in a row, you know, I worked on this story over the expanse of 18 months as far as the photography was concerned. And that was a theme that you could see in any part of any given lake. There was flooding was just a part of it. And it's unfortunately just now a part of what living around the lakes will be.
My guests today are Keith Ledzinski and Tim Folger, the writing and photography team who reported this month's cover spread for National Geographic magazine, Saving the Great Lakes. I'm sorry to make you guys my doctors for aversion therapy, but I need to talk about the lampreys. I turned a page and came to the spread where you were documenting some endangered species. And you guys, these things are pretty intimidating. Keith, can you tell us what you learned about lampreys and the problems that they pose?
We actually went up to a facility where they study lampreys. And the people there could not have been more inviting and excited about lampreys, which is, it's so, you know, the unsung heroes, I think, are the biologists in the field and these people that are studying these big issues. They don't get a whole lot of press. And I think it's an easily overlooked position, but it's so critical. And what's interesting about the lampreys is that, you know, they came over as an invasive through barges. They, you know, I think you could find them in the St. Lawrence. But the lakes themselves, they weren't completely connected until the late 1800s when they were canaled out. And as soon as that happened, you know, the idea, of course, was to make this gigantic commerce route, which is to this day one of the great waterways of the world. The problem is by connecting these gigantic lakes, it allows anything to enter in pretty freely. And so once the lamprey started making its way in, it actually depleted trout populations from four of the five lakes, Superior being the only one that actually weathered the storm a little bit, and it's because of its depth. Well, these researchers were tasked to go in and figure out a solution to you know, tamp this problem down. And what they did was, you know, through vast amounts and years of studying, you know, these patterns as to where these lampreys would breed, they would go to these breeding areas, they would tag them all. They have them all pretty well documented now. And what they do is they take this specific type of poison that they leach into these breeding areas where these lampreys, you know, go and colonize to procreate. And what this is, and this has brought the invasive levels down tremendously, but it's something that needs to be constantly kept up on and done. However, if that were to stop, if we were to stop going to these breeding spawning areas, then they would begin to procreate again and start creating the same levels of damage. And that's something now they're worried about with Asian carp. It's already happening with these mussels that are depleting plankton and everything else. So the Great Lakes, as magnificent and special as this is, as an ecosystem, and it's, I mean, I think Tim put it so perfectly, it's one of our great, you know, one of North America's greatest natural resources. This mismanagement is so unfortunate, and it's just going to be an uphill battle, I think, in perpetuity at this point, unless something dramatic happens.
It feels like that clarity of water has been such a double-edged sword, because people look and they think it's so beautiful here, it's so amazing, but it's actually a major problem. You know, one of the smaller species that people heard a lot about over the past 20 years is zebra mussels, and their feeding has filtered Lake Michigan to this gorgeous clarity. How would you rank the threats that they pose compared to the lamprey?
I mean, right now the mussels are probably one of the biggest threats that the lakes are experiencing, and it's just because these tube feeding mussels, they can siphon all of the nutrients out of the water, which of course at that low level, that plankton, you know, that it just affects everything above it on the food chain. And I think that is the biggest problem at hand right now. And I wish I had an idea of what that solution looks like. I know that it's being very, very looked into because it's affecting the nutrients of the water. But I think that that's probably the biggest invasive issue right now happening in the lakes.
Yeah, despite all the problems that the Great Lakes face, and you know, and some of those problems are immense, there have been some success stories. The zebra and quagga mussels that Keith was talking about, they're just completely well established. That, you know, they number in the hundreds of trillions, and they've permanently altered the, you know, the characteristics of Lake Michigan, and you know, there's no going back from that. But the good news is that the invasion route that the mussels followed into the Great Lakes, that is, they came in the ballast water of ocean-going freighters from Europe. There are now really strict ballast water regulations in place. And one scientist told me that since those regulations have been in place, I think they went into effect in 2008, maybe 2007, over the last decade, there have been no new invasive species detected in ballast water. So that's fantastic that this major invasion route has been more or less completely shut down.
Keith, we've talked a little bit about how, you know, humans have had this pretty negative environmental impact on the Great Lakes, but you also included images of a young man diving into the lake against a sunset and picnickers enjoying themselves at Indiana Dunes National Park. Was it important, do you think, to notice what's positive and healthy about our relationship with the lakes?
Absolutely. I think there's still so much to celebrate and love about the lakes. Part of the story was to go and photograph these warm interactions and this culture that, you know, exists around Great Lakes. I mean, the Great Lakes culture is such a piece of the fabric of North America. I certainly grew to not only love the beauty of the places, but the people around them that inhabited. And I mean, I think there's some 4 million residentially owned boats that inhabit the Great Lakes area. It's an astonishing number. And, you know, you go out in the warm time of year and the beaches are just filled with people, and, you know, it's their getaway. It's their respite. And I think that's what makes the health of the water something that it's just another reason to be deeply concerned about the, you know, we need a better Clean Water and Air Act. We need to definitely be taking this more serious and doing what we can. And the interesting thing about that picture you're referring to is, you know, it sits right along the shores of Gary, Indiana, and southern, you know, the southern Chicago and all the rest of it. And that area is so densely populated, but even still, it continues to have pollution issues. I mean, thousands upon thousands of people swim in these waters. It's such a densely populated area. Once that gets into the water system, I mean, it can freely flow wherever it wants. Tim wrote about accountability in his story, and I think that it's such a strong point. There needs to be greater repercussions for these sorts of things, because if there aren't these sort of accidental things that happen, a slap on the wrist just doesn't do it. There needs to be a greater accountability.
Tim, you write in the story that the immensity of the lakes really belies their fragility. And a Michigander who is also the editor-in-chief at National Geographic, Susan Goldberg, wrote an editorial noting that despite this huge role that the lakes play in our lives, you don't actually hear that much about how they're at risk compared with environmental problems in other parts of the world. Tim, why do you think that is?
I'm not sure. It may be just that we take them for granted, or we think that they're so large that they can't be harmed. But, you know, one day I was on a research vessel with some scientists and their students from the University of Minnesota at Duluth. We were on this ship called the Blue Heron. And we, you know, we sailed out of sight of land, which is kind of an amazing thing to do on a lake that you can't see the shore anymore. And it was this beautiful September day. And I was standing with a scientist at one point on the deck, and he was pointing to this big freighter off in the distance. The freighter was about 1,000 feet long. And the scientist said, you know, if you stood that freighter on its end to end so that its stern was resting on the bottom of Lake Superior, its bow at that point would break the surface of the lake, because the lake at that point was about 900 feet deep. That's really deep for a lake. But the lakes are so broad in extent, you know, several hundred miles, you know, east to west, north to south, just for Lake Superior alone, that their breadth is like, you know, 1,000 times more than their depth. So they're really like, you know, kind of like these thin sheets of water on the surface of the earth. And the scientist said, looking at the lakes in that way just shows how delicate they really are. And then again, the lakes are also surprisingly young. You know, I was surprised to learn that they, even though they started to form at the end of the last ice age 11,000 years ago, they didn't really take their current shape until about 3,000 years ago. So they're younger than the oldest Egyptian pyramids. And because they're younger, they haven't had a lot of time to develop the resilience and diversity of more mature ecosystems. Say, like, you know, like the oceans or the Amazon rainforest. So, you know, they're very vulnerable to newcomers. Like an invader can come in, like the mussels that Keith was talking about, and just completely change the ecosystem. Lake Michigan's just permanently changed.
Tim Folger wrote and Keith Ledzinski photographed the cover story for the December issue of National Geographic, Saving the Great Lakes. Tim, Keith, we really appreciate your work. Thanks for the beautiful spread, and thanks for talking to us.
Thanks very much, April.
Thanks for having us, April.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you on Tuesday.